Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All this sucks.
Even hitting that, because that was always a hot topic when I was up there fishing.
Yeah, I hit that one because Meat Eater put an article out on it that I didn't really like.
So. Oh, did they?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny. I read a post saying that the Hunter Conservationist is a better podcast than the Meat Eater, and I loved it.
Oh, really? Where was that?
It was on my phone. It was on an Instagram post, and I was driving.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah, I was.
I actually said that in like two episodes ago.
Oh, did you?
Okay. Yeah, like the guest we had on, I said. Because she actually approached us, said, hey, I was listening to your episode with the Trappers and you're talking about Alberta Trappers Association working on this caribou project. Well, it's like I was running that project. I'd really like to come on and talk about it. So she did. And she like laid out a bunch of things that she wanted to talk about. And she did a really good job like pitching to come on the show.
Yeah.
And so anyway, she had a really neat kind of statement about just sort of like the challenges of like trying to bring like government and industry and hunters and like all these people together. And so I said in the episode, hey, I want to go back to something that you said to me when you wrote in your email. And I'll just read it out here. The Hunter Conservationist podcast is much better than Meat Eater. and it was like, so maybe that's where the quote come from is because I said it. No.
Yeah, no,
wasn't real.
Well, you know, I don't like myself personally. I don't really tune into the Meat Eater podcast. So, I mean, I used to listen to them lots when I got into, when they first came out, I was listening to Ranella's stuff, but not lately. But no, you got a great show going on. I really enjoy what you've gone to. There is definitely some episode I have to catch up on. So, but how long you been doing this for?
We will be coming up on 3 years this summer.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Well, I think, yeah, let's just get rolling here. So,
sure.
You've been doing it for 3 years.
3 years in August. No, 3 years. July 1st, actually.
Oh, yeah. Nice. Nice. So awesome. So how did you get into, so for the people who are listening here, I'm talking to Mark Hall. Mark Hall, if you're not familiar with him, he's got the Hunter Conservationist podcast. Now you have a few other things on the go. Isn't that right, Mark? In terms of podcasts, or is
we
it
do
just...
so the flagship is Curtis and I host the Hunter Conservationist podcast. Then I run so that's twice a month, pretty rigid on releasing there. Then I have another one called the Round Canada podcast, which is usually just me, and it's kind of comes out maybe once a month, and it's kind of where I go through like trending stories on wildlife science, conservation and responsible or irresponsible hunting and from across Canada. So it's just kind of the recap of what's going on and, you know, and anywhere from 20 minutes to an hour, give people kind of a snapshot of what's going on in the country because, you know, everybody can't read all the stuff in their feeds. And then Curtis and I have a membership-based podcast called the Hunters Underground Podcast, and it's on patreon.com. And so for like $5 a month, you join and we spit out a couple of podcasts, just Curtis and I chatting about whatever, analyzing things, films, articles, chatting about hunting, just whatever.
So, yeah. And that's Curtis Hall. He's your son, right?
You betcha. Yep.
Yeah. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. It's got to keep you pretty busy. That many shows.
It is actually. It is. I was looking at, we use the Squadcast platform for recording and bringing our guests on. And I was like, man, I'm totally getting the warning signals from my account at 5 hours maxed out every month of recordings. Oh, yeah. So now I'm looking at bumping that up to 12.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Not that I'm going to do 12 hours of podcast, but it's like, I just need a little bit more time.
Yeah. Yeah. Just record. A little bit, just in case. You never know. That happened to us last night. We got half an hour in and I signed in with the wrong account, and the session timed out through Zoom. So we had to.
Oh, I had it once where it went, you've got 10 minutes left. Do you want to pay more minutes? Yeah. And I'm like, shit, no, I'm going to wrap this up real fast. Thanks for coming on the show. I'll see you in the next episode.
Yeah, no doubt. So maybe, Mark, maybe you could talk just a little bit about your background and you know, how you got into, you know, well, obviously, I imagine you've probably been involved in hunting your whole life, but just how you got into like this side of hunting, you know what I mean? Being you're pretty active and you're a great spokesman and you're very educated on all these issues. So how did you like talk a little bit about your background if you could?
Sure. I mean, I was born on Christmas Eve.
Yeah.
That's true. That's a
fact. Oh, really?
Christmas Eve. Oh, okay. Christmas Eve, 1966. Yep. My very first possession I ever had in life was a toy hunting rifle that my grandfather brought to me at the hospital in Cranbrook on Christmas morning. Wow. So, but it's yeah, I'm like third generation hunting and trapping family in British Columbia. My dad is a hunter. Everybody, the Hall family was quite big on my dad's side, and they were all hunting. Like Hall, H stood for Halls. Hockey and hunting, and it was just kind of like that's all you ever talked about, and that's all you ever did. But it's kind of interesting growing up as a kid, like nature and animals were my passion, and I had a tremendous regard and level of empathy for all things living as a kid. I wasn't the kid that went around and like shot things with the BB gun or whatever. I was the kid. It was like had my dad's tools, and I was out back behind our house by the government warehouse, and I'm like chiseling their pavement, big chunks out of their pavement, because there was a little tree trying to grow up through the pavement along the edge of the building. And I'm like, well, this tree's going to die. So I chiseled a big hole out and dug it out and transplanted it. And like 30 feet high now, or wherever it's planted, property got sold or whatever. But so my family actually thought he's never going to be a hunter. Like he just cares, like he's got too much empathy and stuff for animals. But I did. I became a hunter, and more recently just a trapper. Both my dad and my grandfather trapped and stuff. So I grew up with it. I actually wanted to become a wildlife biologist when I finished school. And I graduated in 1984 from Smithers Senior Secondary School. And I really wanted to be a wildlife biologist. Like that was my passion. And I went and met with one of the government biologists in Smithers. And he was saying, like, if you want to become a wildlife biologist, I really recommend like getting your bachelor's, your master's, and potentially even thinking about your PhD. It's a very competitive field. And at that time, you know, there was, he said, the only jobs that would be available would be to work for government. So it's like few jobs, a lot of competition. You better go the distance with your education. And I was still in grade 12 and I was like, holy shit, man. It's like, I don't want to go to school for that much. But this fella said to me, he said, but I'll tell you something. He said, a wildlife biologist has jurisdiction over the animals themselves to manage the wildlife. But a forester has legal jurisdiction over the wildlife's habitat. And a forester can have more impact on wildlife, positive or negative, in a single day in his or her career than a wildlife biologist might be able to have over their entire career. And so I went into forestry, got a degree in forestry, followed up with a master's in environment management. But I did a tremendous amount of my career working in on wildlife projects, wildlife habitat projects, restoration, assessing, you know, sheep winter range, and, you know, doing that type of stuff. And spend most of my career working for myself. And then I've had experiences working in the mining sector, in forestry, in oil and gas up north. So, you know, the conversations we've all been having about the cumulative impacts in northeastern BC. Unfortunately, I was part of that for a few years, you know, that industry, exploring for shale gas reserves up there. But I also firsthand kind of saw the impacts to the land up there. I'm quite familiar with what, you know, the court decision was talking about. I've seen it firsthand. So yeah. I spent my whole life in the natural resource management sector and hunting, and my career secondary, and my passion is this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that kind of definitely explains a lot, at least for me, because I know, you know, I've listened to a lot of the stuff you got going on, and you have a great reputation for just being very well educated and all this stuff. So that definitely puts the dots together. Myself, I wish I would have been a little bit more involved when I was younger. Myself, I'm 43. I was born in 78. So, I mean, obviously I grew up in the outdoors, living in Prince Rupert, not far from Smithers. But I just never paid attention enough to the wildlife aspect of it. Like, obviously hunting and fishing was huge, even, you know, up till, you know, a couple of years ago. So,
yeah,
cool. So
I've kind of got a really important person in my life that kind of set a bar that's really my driver for trying to make a difference for hunting and trapping and fishing and wildlife in this province. And that was my grandfather.
Oh yeah.
My grandfather had this passion for wildlife, talked about it every second, every moment. He was in the forestry office, he was in the wildlife branch office, always talking about something for wildlife and wildlife habitat. And he actually, back in the 1970s, approached the MLA, Terry Segerty, in the East Kootenai riding, and said, hey, we need more money for wildlife management, wildlife projects on the ground. Here's this idea. Let's take a tax off the natural resource industries and put it into a special fund that just used to manage wildlife habitat. And a few other people got involved kind of in that conversation. They flew it through Victoria, and there kind of wasn't the appetite in the 70s to kind of like put a resource tax on like the forest industry and the mining industry. Some back and forth pursued, long story short, they landed on a surcharge that is on our hunting, fishing, guide, outfitter, and trapper's license, and a fund that's now called the Habitat Conservation Trust Foundation. And my grandfather was one of about four men, along with MLA Terry Segerty, that were the architects of that. And I hold that pretty near to my heart because of his love for that. And that is a big driver of my education, my advocacy, and just standing up for hunting.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Yeah, no doubt. Yeah, I when you were telling me that, I thought maybe you were going to say it was going to be something like the Pittman-Robertson Act, but it got shut down, which wouldn't surprise me. I mean, like, I wonder
it was sort of that idea.
Yeah.
It was, there wasn't much of an appetite to take.
Yeah. What do you think? Sorry, go ahead, Pete.
I was going to say, even like the idea, like kind of going on that there, like that those kind of, you know, a portion coming off those sorts of things where we've talked about before, down in different states, you know, like, I don't know if it's that, you named it before,
talking about a sporting
goods tax, you know, if it's like on hunting gear or fishing gear, you know.
Yeah, well, there's two different. There's the Pittman-Roberts and Dingell-Johnson. The Pittman-Roberts is 11%, and the Dingell-Johnson is 10%. So there's two different things that they got going on down there.
So the PNR DJ acts. Yeah. So the Pittman-Roberts is on firearms and ammunition sales in the United States. And then it's states apply to the federal fund because it's a federal excise tax. And then it's proportionally dispersed back to projects at the state level, kind of based on where the sales came from. Dingle Johnson is on fishing gear, motorboats, marine fuel, those sorts of things. And it's in it aimed more at the fisheries and aquatic sort of things, but it's big. Like two of those together, I think, are, you know, always around $1 billion a year. Yep. In the United States. And it's population based. I mean, you took in British Columbia, if you took all the fees, all the hunting license and all the tag revenue and put it into Habitat Conservation Trust Foundation, we would never touch the numbers like that. Even like a little tiny state like Idaho, you know, generates with a fraction number of people because they got more hunters per capita kind of thing. So, but where our wealth is in our natural resources. And, you know, you've had the conversations we've had at, you know, so many of these conflicts, you know, in hunting and fishing sort of always point back to how the land is managed. Mm-hmm. And unsustainable resource extraction and impacts on the lands and roads everywhere and access everywhere and mines and water quality and all this kind of stuff. And it's like, but that's where the money can come from to fix all of it. And
yeah. And it's a tough subject. I know, you know, there's 300, there's 10 times the amount of people down in the States. And they even like hunters, like John Stallone and I were talking, we were comparing numbers of hunters. I mean, you look at 1 million hunters in Canada compared to over 15 million there. We just don't have the numbers. And when it comes to those Pittman Roberts enacts, it goes for like outdoor equipment. So like hikers, you know, people just enjoying recreating the outdoors. And like you mentioned, at that level, it's a numbers game. It's a population game.
Yeah.
We just don't have it. So.
It's, you know, but there was the Ontario Federation of Anglers and Hunters, I think published or commissioned or were part of a commissioned report that was released, I think about 2 years ago, just prior to COVID, that was like a summary of hunting, fishing, trapping, revenue by province, you know, for all of Canada. Mm-hmm. And some of those numbers are pretty big, you know, contributions to the GDP and those sorts of things. They're pretty big numbers.
Yeah.
Like in British Columbia, the provincial taxes that are collected strictly off of hunter spending, I think was about $375 million. It's 10 times what we spend on wildlife management in this province. We actually generate, even though we've only got 110,000 resident hunters in the province, we generate that much through our spending.
Yeah, there's probably a big chunk of that coming from me. So
I know, me too. I'm the other half of that. So
yeah,
honey, I'm just doing my part to support the economy and keep the schools open.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, that's obviously, I've had this conversation with a number of people before getting that money out. Like, if I wish there was a tool or something we can use to get that money, like more of that money allocated back into the wildlife of this province. But again, that, you know, that's something
it's
we have
political to advocacy. Yeah. It's keeping the money that's spent on looking after the land, fish, water, wildlife, mm-hmm. habitat. The money that's spent on that, as you guys have probably seen this from Jesse and the BC Wildlife Federation, how it's like, it's going down, you know, like back in the 60s, I think, you know, it was like 0.6% of the provincial budget was allocated to the natural resource industries to manage the natural resources. And 40 years later, it's like 0.04% or something. Like every successive government for the last 30 or 40 years is consistently like giving less and less and less to the dirt ministries and increasing the budgets in every other sector in the province. So, you know, to reverse that, we've got to keep the focus on there needs to be more money put back into managing this resource. Otherwise, we're seeing what we're seeing: dwindling populations, impacts to the land that aren't being fixed, and conflict over who gets what of a shrinking pie. That is a recipe for disaster. It's what Jesse calls managing to zero, right?
Yeah, that's kind of what we have going on now, a bit of that, right? So.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Like the whole moose and caribou thing up north is, you know, to some degree, you know, related to the resource extraction industry. And in some cases, you know, due to scarcity. So if you think about the level of advocacy that's happened on that hunting regulation in the last few weeks, it's we have to be able to sustain that year after year on all of our elected officials when it comes to telling them we need more to manage supernatural British Columbia.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And so, I think we need to, as resident hunters, we need to take the onus upon ourselves, and we need to be more engaged and keep the pressure on, like even before this, after this, we all, you know what I mean? Like putting that pressure on our elected officials to say, hey, we need more spending. We need more spending. Don't just wait till something's on the table or proposed to be taken away and then start, you know, putting your 2 cents in, kind of just doing it all the time, doing it once a month, right? Just writing a letter. If you already have the email yep. address, you already have the physical address, just send another letter away, right? Just that's,
I think one of the big tipping points that I have seen with this moose and caribou regulation controversy in 7B has been the change of a couple of key groups down in the US getting on board. So Robbie Kroger at Blood Origins kind of like started to champion this concept of getting hunters united and together and educated and informed and aware of hunting issues globally. And I don't really know anybody that kind of is plugged into like sort of the global issues. I track stuff, but it's like, I don't even touch the African stuff. Cause it's like, man, I don't know. I'll learn. He knows, you know, he's from there. So he, you know, he started to really focus on, you know, like, hey people, this is hunting. We're all hunters. Here's this thing going on in Australia. They're trying to ban duck hunting. They're trying to, you know, ban, you know, grouse hunting in the moors of, you know, England and this sort of stuff. And he started bringing this awareness and this education and the truth about hunting. And then more recently, the Howl for Wildlife has kind of stepped in, sort of doing the same thing, but they've complemented that awareness of hunting issues globally to rallying people behind some of the technology that they brought to the table, being these call centers. And they picked up on the issues here in British Columbia, and literally like thousands of messages were going to elected officials across British Columbia because of them getting involved in an advocacy campaign. And that's, in my mind, has been a real game changer here in the last, like literally like in the last month.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
because I'm seeing Americans wanting to be educated and understand issues that are happening here in Canada, and then saying, okay, now that we understand it, what can we do to help?
Yeah. Yeah. And it goes both ways too. And I've had guys on this podcast that I've met through and become good friends with, talk to them, you know, almost on a daily basis. And they keep me up to speed on what's going on down, you know, like when with the Washington bear hunts, one example, right? And yeah, that Howl for Wildlife, that, yeah, I mean, I can't say enough about those guys there. They're really advocating for unity within the hunting community, which is really good, because that's one thing about hunting. I mean, that's one thing that makes hunting great and we all love it, is because it's unique, and everybody has their own little, you know, has their own little world inside the hunting realm, right? Inside the hunting universe. But you know, if that can, it's going to be either a crux or a strength. So the way they've done it, it pulled it all together for us.
Like I said, I kind of see that as a tipping point, you know, here in BC, because we've all connected across the border, you know, with these people with a broader interest in hunting globally in North America, and a willingness to learn and support advocacy campaigns here in Canada. And so, you know, our ability to collaborate with them and put this whole issue of how much money is given back to the ministries to manage wildlife in the province of British Columbia needs to be a constant thing that we work with them to get an advocacy campaign out. Here's the call center. get a hold of your, you know, your MLAs, plug your information in, and it'll send out 85 messages saying, hey, you know, and we can time that. We can time that when there's like budget times coming up, and the standing committee on finance, when you make presentations, like, we got to start, you know, picking the right time and pushing that agenda. And I think their ability to help us with that, and the fact that they're interested in that, would be huge. I do see it as a game changer. What's happened with this move?
Yeah,
thing.
Me too. Yeah.
I think some of the best things when I went on to, when you were talking with Howl for Wildlife there, I went on and I was like, well, I'll check this out. And I know probably two best things. The first one was how easy they've made it. Mm. It was something else. It was just, you went in there and it was so simple to sign up. Just put your info in. You're kept up to date on anything new coming up. You know, it just goes to your email and everything. You get a little update on something that's happening somewhere else. And then when you start reading about how they send their letters out to the MLAs, it's not the same letter for everybody. You know, they switch the letters up. It actually has your email address. So it's not like, oh, Focus Hunting has sent us 2,500 emails in the last hour and a half.
Yep.
We'll just delete all those. But when it's consistent, like, it seems like they've really figured it out, and I'm sure they're fine tuning it to, you know, as they go along and everything, but it's crazy the traction they're getting. And I think,
yeah. And they haven't been going that long either. So, yeah, I mean, it's only going to evolve and it's only going to get bigger, and hopefully they keep gaining support, because it could be like Mark said, it's already a game changer, but I mean, it could be what we need. Yeah.
You know, and the other part of this that I think is a bit of a game changer is, you know, the impetus behind Curtis and I starting the Hunter Conservationist podcast was a little bit born out of sort of this exact thing. And it started kind of around the grizzly bear debate, and on social media and various platforms. Like, I saw hunters here from British Columbia reaching out to people in the States, directly reaching out to Stephen Ranella on Instagram or whatever, saying, we need some help up here. Like, you came up here and you filmed a hunt, you were trying to get a grizzly bear in British Columbia, now we're going to lose that hunt. Like, we need your voice as a spokesperson for hunting, right? And it was met with silence. Like, there just wasn't people that were, it's like, oh, it's Canada, like, we'll go up there and hunt and then go back down and produce our films and do all our things and say, you know, here's the great American hunting experience, but we're not really that interested in, you know, your hunting opportunities, your regulations, your wildlife management, the history and conservation and all that. And I felt bad for Canadians and I felt bad for British Columbians, like, that there was nothing in Canada to, like, for them to say, this is our vehicle to have these conversations, and they care about it. And, you know, and so that's why we got into it and just said, let's get the conversation happening about Canada and cover Canadian stories and, you know, try to help. And so, but it's different now. It's a little different now. They're getting involved in these things at the outset. Everybody down in the US was covering the story when the grizzly bear hunt was banned in BC, and all of a sudden there was grizzly bear experts everywhere. And it's like, none of them got the information right. I'm just like, oh my God, you guys, it's like, don't cover the story unless you got the facts. And so, but it's different now. They're getting educated and then they're saying, how can we support you? Hunting's hunting.
Yeah. That's great. It's funny how that works. You know, with like Ranella and those, you know, and he's not the only one. I mean, there's, with this stuff going on now and with other stuff, it's kind of just met with silence, you know, the guys in the TV industry. And there's a, you know, there's a handful of guys that have a good reach in British Columbia. And, you know, I've reached out to a few of them in the same thing, you know, regarding the 7B stuff, like, hey, can you weigh in on this? Can you be a voice for BC resident hunters, and not just BC resident hunters, but, you know, just hunters in general. And yeah, not even a reply. So yeah, it's just interesting.
Do you think they're worried about backlash and, you know, loss of, I don't know if I want to say revenue, but views or viewers for their shows or stuff? Or why do you think that
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I mean, obviously, you know, when you're involved in, if that's your profession and, you know, if you're on TV, obviously everything's a little different, right? You know what I mean? Everything, obviously it's a lot different than it is for, you know, yourself or myself.
I think there's two things when you're in the public, when you're a public figure, quote unquote, public figure. Being involved and having a say and being in the middle of things that are controversial about hunting and wildlife management gains you a lot of traction, and it helps you in your business and your platform and what you're doing, or it could completely devastate you.
Right.
Because you get, you know, you get into these things and they're like pretty complicated, and you stick your neck out getting involved and making a statement, and then everybody like jumps on you and it's wrong. And then you got to like go on and apologize and say you didn't know, and, you know, yeah, and whatever, and you slap the host of the Oscars and then you got to apologize for it afterwards. It's just sort of, so some people are like, some people, you know, I get it. Public figures are like, fuck it, I'm getting involved. Yeah, I'm just going to, exactly. I'm going to say things. Randy Newberg gets in the middle of stuff down in the States and he just says it, you know, he says what he says. Other people, they're very careful, because it's like, if you get tangled up in something and you're like, it turns on you and your viewers turn on you going, how the hell, why could you stand for that? Or why did you say that? And then all of a sudden the sponsor's going, holy hell, what did you do? Right.
Yeah, exactly. And
so there's the two types, the ones that just sort of don't care if their sponsors are going to leave, they're going to stand up for hunting, and others that are just very careful about the PR and, you know, their public image and stuff. And
yeah, that's true. And I think that just, it all depends on the personality himself for sure. Yeah, that's great. So Pacific Salmon Treaty, when I lived up in Prince Rupert, this was a big issue. I remember I commercial fished up there, and the salmon fishermen always accuse the Alaska government of taking too much fish. And it seems like it's going on again. I was reading through your stories on Instagram, Mark, and I pulled a couple off there, and I don't follow the fishing stuff probably as much as I need to. I kind of focus more on the hunting stuff, but maybe you could just give a little recap of what's going on there.
So there were two groups that were commissioned, I'm just looking at the report here. So a recent report commissioned by Skeena Wild Conservation Trust and Watershed Watch Salmon Society revealed that Southeast Alaska commercial fisheries are catching huge numbers of salmon. So Skeena Wild Conservation Trust and Watershed Watch Salmon Society, both here in British Columbia, commissioned a report to look into the harvest of salmon stocks by the Alaskan fisheries, and then produced a report that basically sort of laid out how shocking, you know, the volume of fish that were being taken, fish that were leaving Alaska waters bound for British Columbia rivers to spawn. So obviously that benefits, you know, Alaska, because those fish have got to spawn and make more fish and go back, and, you know, the more the merrier for everybody. So, but it, you know, as you know, we're seeing declines in salmon on steelhead stocks across almost all the major river systems in British Columbia, whether they're South Pacific or they're going the North Way. And Canada has curtailed and reduced and cut back on commercial fisheries, you know, they're saying the Alaskans haven't.
Yeah,
the coalition says that commercial fishing was nearly non-existent in BC last summer. Alaskan fleets just across the border logged over 3,000 boat days and harvested over 650,000 Canada-bound sockeye.
Yeah, so they're just being irresponsible in how they're managing it. Yeah, I know that was always a hot topic when I lived up there. The fishermen, I didn't salmon fish. So I worked on the much nastier stuff. I did some crabbing and halibut fishing and worked on a trawler. So I've seen some pretty gross stuff, but
yeah, I'm not super familiar with like the treaty.
Mm-hmm.
So how this actually, you know, lines up with the treaty to say, look, you're you know, you are in contravention in our opinion of article number, like whatever. Yeah. I haven't dug to that level. Mm-hmm. These folks have, Greg Taylor from Watershed Watch Salmon Society and Mr. McDuffie from the Rain Coast Conservation Foundation were kind of like the key gatekeepers on, you know, this, compiling this information. They would have a better idea of how this lines up to the, to the treaty, but everything I've read on it, you know, reporting out on this is, seems to point to the fact that it's not in keeping with the salmon treaty US. So
to your knowledge, do the BC government and the Alaska officials, do they work in coordination on the distribution of the salmon?
So this is federal. So anything would be federal.
The federal government,
DFO. Yep.
Yeah.
Okay. Yep. So they would need to be engaging with the United States or the state of Alaska on the Pacific Salmon Treaty, which apparently it was at the time this was all coming out, the countries were actually meeting about the Pacific Salmon Treaty. So.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Pretty interesting stuff. Like I said, I figured I'd touch on that. I seen you're hitting it there on your stories.
Yeah. So the reason I kind of like had that in the story feed there on the weekend was Meat Eater had published an article. One of their staff writers from Alaska wrote an article that basically was blaming British Columbia for the decline of salmon stocks in Alberta because of our mining industry. So in northwestern British Columbia on the Taku River, there's an abandoned mine called the Tulsiqua mine. And it was a metal mine that was not closed properly. The company, I think it was like Chief Metals or Chieftain Metals or something like that, went bankrupt and they couldn't complete their closure. And so this mine is what's referred to as an acid generating mine. So when they get in, you dig the ore body out, the minerals and the rock and stuff mix with air and bacteria, and it becomes acid. The rainwater that washes off of this exposed rock has incredibly low pH. And when that water works its way through the rocks, the low pH, the acid water, dissolves heavy metals out of the rock. So your zincs and cadmiums and leads and these sorts of things, which are really bad for living organisms. And then that drains into the water systems and you can cause pollution, which can be detrimental to the aquatic environment. So that's going on with the Tulsiqua mine. And they basically like blamed like this abandoned mine and that nothing's being done with it. There is stuff being done with it. And I was kind of like, hold the phone here a little bit. It's like, there is stuff going on with efforts to impose enforcement on the company that now owns the mine property. There's work being done. They're trying to commission a water treatment plant. There's a collaborative effort between British Columbia and the state of Alaska monitoring fish and metal toxicity and all this sort of stuff. And I don't think it's quite as bad. Like the mine is not that bad that it's causing this wholesale, like, you know, death and destruction on millions of salmon that are trying to get past it up to their spawning grounds.
Right.
But that was kind of what you got from the article. And I'm like, okay, well, let's talk about your commercial fishing industry. And so I laid out all these reports and stories that are like, hey, these fishing stocks are collapsing because they spawn in British Columbia. We've parked and cut back on our commercial fishing industry because these stocks are so low from a conservation perspective, yet you're fishing the hell out of them in Southeast Alaska. So I was kind of like, why didn't we talk about that? Right.
Yeah,
you know, in the story. So I was a little frustrated. So
yeah, easier for them, I guess they say, well, we'll just point our fingers at this. And
I mean, I heard from them probably within the hour of that.
Oh, did you? Oh, good.
Yep.
Oh, good. Yep.
Awesome.
Good.
So, and it was positive, you know, so Curtis and I helped another staff writer, meat eater, write an article on the moose issue up north.
Yeah.
So, you know, we have started to develop a relationship with a writer there. And sort of like, you know, we heard back from meat eater and kind of said like, okay, like we get it. Like it's we're only looking at this from one perspective.
Right.
Which well, that's is like good. Alaskan awesome. Perspective. And it's like, and that was my point, right? It's like the decline of salmon stocks is like from a conservation perspective, like it's cumulative impacts. It's like what we've been talking about with the Yehi decision. It's a whole bunch of stuff. It's like, it's the plastics that are going in the ocean. It's the logging in the headwaters that are silting and losing spawning habitat. It's dams and bridges and pollution. And we play a part in that with our fish farms in the ocean, you know, and the lice. And so everybody has a role to play here. And I'm kind of like, let's all recognize that it's cumulative impacts. We can all play a role. And again, let's have the conversations that are bringing people together, not dividing people. And I just kind of saw this as a dividing narrative, Southeast Alaska against British Columbia kind of thing. So,
Well, I kind of like how you, you know, you're, like you said, you're building, it seems like you've built a bit of a relationship with them, which is great. Cause in the future, you know, if there's an article that's coming out or an issue that's coming out, you know, they might actually just give you a shout and be like, hey, what's your take on this now?
Yeah. And that's exactly what happened on the moose thing.
Yeah, that's good.
You know? So it was like, hey, can we get together? And like, we need to figure out what this is. Cause we want to write a story on it. And it's like, that's absolutely fantastic because it's like, first and foremost, it's like, talk to somebody that's there, you know, in the know. Not that I'm the only one that I could have, I said right off the bat, I said, everything I know about what's up north, it's like, you can get out of Jesse Zeman's head. You know, it's kind of like, so, but anyways, like that's where the connection was made and, you know, whatever, but it was like, a lot of information comes from Jesse, but making that local contact to get the local story. And it was even like, it's even down to like, okay, in British Columbia, we refer to them as First Nations or Indigenous peoples. In the United States, it's absolutely respectful to refer to them as tribes.
Right.
Because they have, you know, the whatever, you know, Snohomie tribe or the, all the various tribes, but it's like the language is different.
Yeah.
So just writing and making sure that you get that right is like just a little thing.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, British Columbia government, not the federal, not the Canadian government. Like, so, you know, and that's why I don't dive into things in other countries is because it's like, you know, I have no freaking idea.
Yeah. Well, I mean, absolutely. Yeah.
I love that they're starting to take an interest and that they're reaching out to get informed before the articles are written, because the Alaska one wasn't. I wish it would have, but maybe that'll be different next time.
Yeah, moving forward for sure.
I love the international coverage because I think it puts more pressure politically in this country, and it gives us a bigger voice when outside entities are covering the story and getting involved. And when people from other countries are phoning our elected officials saying, hey, we kind of don't like what you're doing to your resident hunters up there. It's like, damn right. So I'm going to, you know, anybody that wants my time, I'll help them out with the story. So,
yeah, no, it's pretty positive when you get those, when you get our neighbors there involved too. It's like, fuck yeah, God, good job, boys. We're going to work together. No, I love it. Yeah, that's good.
I have always held the American way of managing wildlife, the money they pour into research, and the will of both their political systems and their people to stand up and defend the tradition and heritage of hunting.
Yeah.
Like are so passionate about wildlife management, wildlife science, research, hunting, and protecting hunting. It's absolutely inspirational on all fronts, you know, how much they're involved. And I have always wanted more of that to catch on, you know, here in Canada, because, you know, here in Canada, you know, there'll be an issue come up about, you know, something to do with hunting. Let's just bring up the grizzly bear hunt or whatever, yep, or this moose thing or whatever. Yep. Everybody gets all like up in arms about mm-hmm. it. And it, but it's like, do something about it. Take some actual actions, call your MLAs. And then you kind of get the, well, it's not, I tried that one time and they don't listen and there's no point. They're just going to do what they want to do. And all of a sudden it's like, it's just sort of like, but you see things in the States and it's like, holy hell, they get fired up and it's like, they don't give up.
No, they don't. You know? Yeah. And that's,
they're going to take our guns away in Canada, damn government, and screw them or whatever. And down in the States, it's like they got armed militias to say, no, you're not touching our constitutional right to own these things. Right. And so, I've always wished that we had a little bit more of that. Up here.
It'd be nice. I don't know if that goes back to a numbers thing or just, I don't know what it is. Maybe too much apathy up here, but yeah.
I mean, it you're probably right on that. There are some incredibly passionate, overworked volunteers in fish, wildlife, and habitat in this province and in this country that are just always out there advocating and rallying and trying to do stuff, trying to get people fired up, trying to get the momentum and a movement and stuff. And maybe it is a proportional thing, but when you have 1% of your hunting community is willing to just continually be hammering on issues in British Columbia, that's like a few hundred people. When it's in the state of Texas, it's like, it's a million people that are like really vocal about it. Right. And that's 1% of their hunting population, whatever.
Hopefully, you know, one thing that this is, you know, good or bad, the outcome of it. I mean, hopefully hopefully we can keep as hunters, we can keep this momentum going and we just, you know, we start working proactively rather than just having a reaction to something that's already, you know, it seems like when something comes out for proposal, the decision's already made and it's like, okay, this is, you know, we're just putting this out here just to appease you guys. So,
well, I think that's part of the frustration with the 7B moose caribou proposal, right? Is I think people are thinking that like the decision has been made and it's just now coming out for public comment. Everybody in this province knows that we're on a 2-year hunting regulation cycle and we're actually past the deadline of like getting your changes in for the next 2 years, because the hunting regulations need, like, the order in council needs to be signed off by the lieutenant governor, then the hunting regulations have to get drafted off the hunting regulation change, the OIC, and then they got to get out into people's hands because hunting season starts in northern British Columbia on the 1st of August in some places. Yep. And so like we're really getting down to the wire, and I think people know that. They know we are past the midnight due date on what should have been cut off. That goes like in a year from now, we'll start talking about that for 2 years down the road. And so that, I think that made people feel like, well, they're trying to jam this in at the last second because they have already decided, yes, you know, they're going to do this regardless, but we've got to go through this motion and ask for public comment and stuff. So I think that added to the frustration and the anxiety of everybody around this thing, because there was this thing of like, they knew the time pressure. People in the province knew the time pressure. And I think you're exactly right. I think people are like, you know, they got loud because they think the decision had already been made. And so,
Yeah, it's tricky. I mean, it's, I guess time will tell, I guess, unfortunately. I mean, there's obviously some people who know, but we're not one of them. So,
well, I can honestly say from what I've heard, the amount of MLA involvement and they, you know, that they've heard, like individual ministers in the north have got like upwards of like 1,000 phone calls and emails and stuff from, you know, on this. So like there's nobody in the province, elected officials, that aren't on top of this. And if they care and they're representing their constituents, they're passing that message on to the minister, right? So that's a big deal. Like that takes serious consideration, you know, at a cabinet level to say, you know.
Yeah, well, even when an opposing change. Yeah, even when an opposing party puts out, you know, they're hosting a webinar on Wednesday regarding these regulation changes. I don't know if you've seen that, but
yeah, on the 30th.
Yeah, so that'll be interesting. But we've been chatting here for a bit, Mark. So, but I want to talk about your turkey course.
Oh yeah, I know.
Turkey season's coming up.
Yeah, did you see the smile on Pete's face over there as soon as I said that? You know, I'd love to keep this conversation going, and but I mean, we got to have some fun stuff here. So maybe you can just tell me a bit about that exactly. You know, how long it's been going on and what it is, and guys that sign up for it, what they can kind of expect out of it.
So before COVID, I was just getting myself established to do some courses like face-to-face on sort of an introduction to wild turkey hunting in British Columbia. And I delivered one course in Cranbrook and then was getting ready to go over to Kelowna and do one and down to the coast, kind of partnered with Dylan from Eat Wild. And he reached out and like, That was super popular down there. It was going to be kind of a sold out show sort of thing. And then COVID hit and the airline travel thing. And so like all the group meetings were canceled. And so they fell off the wayside. So that winter, I decided to just spend the winter and put together an online course. Mm-hmm. It's all video based, narrated, pictures, video, bit of film and whatnot. And I created this pretty comprehensive course. I think it ended up being way bigger than I thought it would be, because I spent the better part of the winter working on it. So it's an online course. You can sign up for a fee, and then you can work at your own pace through it, like any online learning platform. You know, you can skip to the chapters, you know, you do whatever and come back and forth and whatnot, work at your own pace or whatever. So it's like I've been hunting wild turkeys here in the East Kootenays for like 20 years now. And it's like, it's my thing.
Yeah.
And I basically have taken, because I started out from ground zero, like knowing absolutely nothing to where I am now. And so I've taken all of that for 20 years, not to say like I'm the expert, I'm just saying this is what I've learned and this is what works for me. And I've completely dumped all of that into this course, absolutely everything I know. The only thing I haven't done is put an X on a map. But if you're really good at following what I do in teaching you how to e-scout areas, identify areas, pre-season scout them, and get yourself set up in the right locations at the right time of the day when hunting season's on, there's a possibility we'll bump into each other.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I thought you were going to say for an extra $100 fee, I'll give you the X.
No. I was going to ask you how much it was. I'll get in the truck and I'll head down right now and have an entity in person.
So that's the course. And I think it's probably unique, you know, in North America. It is specific to British Columbia because it's perfect. British Columbia terrain, our habitat types, whatever, it's the Merriam subspecies, their behaviors, what they like to do, where they're going to be, their feeding patterns, all this kind of stuff. It's like, I don't know about turkeys in the Eastern states and.
Yeah. Well, you know. I think they're a lot different too. Like I think there's a big difference. I mean, I've only hunted the Merriams here, and I started out, I'm a Northerner. I came down here and was hunting for a little bit. And then I was like, oh man, I'm going to go try. I started watching turkey shows on TV.
Geez,
and I was like,
geez, your guys gross are really big.
Yeah, exactly. So then I was like, man, I'm going to go give turkeys a whirl. And everyone's like, you're going to do what? And then like I hunted that first year. I hunted almost every day of the spring turkey season. I didn't miss a day. Like I had to go to work. I'd get up at 2 a.m.
Drive
to a turkey spot, hope for a gobble, I'd be running around there with my head cut off. Did that all the first year, didn't get nothing. The second year, it took me half a year. I finally got one. And then it's been, I mean, obviously every year has its own challenges, Last spring, I was ready just to throw in the towel with turkey hunt. I was done. Like, even going into the fall, I was done with turkey hunt. I was like, it's like, fuck this. It's going to be like my golf clubs. I'm done with it, right? Like, but luckily in the fall, I stumbled. I fortuitously stumbled into a flock and I got one. So I was like, you know what? Turkey hunt's not that bad.
It's better. It's funny because, yeah, I've had
people better to be lucky than good.
Yeah. Oh,
absolutely. I'll take luck any day of the week, whatever brings the bird home. Yeah, I've had the same thing with people looking at me funny too. And I've gone out and it's just like, it's so cool to be sitting there in the dark, you know, waiting for daybreak and that kind of stuff.
Yep.
And you hear that gobble. And oh my God, I tell you, there's nothing that gets the heart pumping.
Oh, it's amazing.
You can't do anything yet. You're just trying to locate it and be like, okay, what am I going to do now?
Yeah.
And it's so exhilarating. And then if you actually get one in the right mood, you know, can work them up. Just like, I look at it just like elk hunting, especially
it is pretty similar. So it's like, if you're a good elk hunter, you can transfer the tactics and you will see a lot of very similar behaviors of the toms.
Oh, okay.
And as one of the things I do in the course, like one of the sections is I'll tell you about all these different ways in my experience that a tom turkey will react to your calls, like how it's going to come into you. And it, like, I give them all names. There's the one that I call like the straight liner. So it's like, if you're in the dark and a tom gobbles in a tree and you hand call and he gobbles back, he knows you're there. There are the toms that when it's light enough and they fly down, they straight line right to you. Yep. As fast as they can go, they're coming at you. And they're just all of a sudden like, wham, there they are. And they're looking around like, where's this hen, right? It's one of the reasons I say it's like, don't call until you're set up, ready, everything on the ground and your gun's on your knee. Because if it's one of those ones, it's going to be standing there looking at you before you're like, well, maybe I should worship, I should under that. Holy shit, there it is right there. I learned that the hard way. There's the other ones that'll like the dawdler. He'll fly down out of the tree in the morning, gobble, 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 hen call, gobble, 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 gobble. And then you're like, any second now, you expect to see this red head. And it's like 45 minutes later, it's like, where the fuck is he? He's like, oh my God, oh, he's still over there. And it's like, what the hell? And it's like, that's the tom that's like, yeah, I'm headed your way, but I'm freaking hungry. So I'm going to eat. And there's like things catch my attention. It's like, oh, there's a bug and there's a butterfly and there's some good grass and all this kind of stuff. And it takes them an hour to cover, you know, like 50, 60 yards to get to you. So I show all that stuff so that you can hopefully be more successful. There's one called the fader, which comes out of the tree, gobbling. You sure he's going to come right to you. And all of a sudden it's like, I think he's farther away than he was 10 minutes ago. Right. Yeah. He just slowly moves away.
Yeah. And it's that's like the one I run into the most.
That's the fader.
I see that guy every year, that guy.
That's because he is roosted with hens.
Gotcha.
And the hens come down and they hear the other hen over there squawking. And sometimes a hen will come and check you out. 99% of the time, they're like, we're going the other way. And that tom will not leave live birds in front of him to go to a sound.
Right.
He gobbles his head off because he's excited.
Yeah.
But he just gets farther and farther away. But then I actually lay out a strategy of how to hunt that bird over the course of the morning.
Awesome.
I'm definitely going to have to check that out.
It's all there, like I said, and I've dumped absolutely everything, you know, that I've learned over the years into it. And like, you know, I think if you were in Idaho or even in Montana or something like that, or in Alberta, if you had one of the permits, this is going to help you because geographically, the lay of the land, kind of what the birds do and the habitat types are going to be in, they're going to be like pretty useful information. So,
well, that's pretty cool. Cause I've like, you know, down in the States, they have, you know, they have like Tree Line Pursuit and they have, you know, Corey Jacobson's got his Elk 101, but I've never seen one for turkey. So
I even go like right back, if you're interested in this kind of stuff, because I am so interested and so passionate about wild turkeys and wild turkey hunting. Like I've run these things right to ground. It's like, where did they come from?
Right.
And I'm talking about the Bering Land Bridge and the ancestral peafowl that came over the Bering Land Bridge and the evolution and where the fossils have been found and how old this bird is on the North American continent, where they were post-glaciation, where they were at the time of European contact, wow. All the different subspecies, the Mayans had actually like domesticated a wild turkey. Called, I think it was the Mexican wild turkey, which is the Cortez actually took it back to Europe. And then the European pilgrims actually brought it back to the east coast of the States, the domestic turkey. The domestic turkey the Mayans created went extinct, but every single domestic turkey in the world has DNA from that domesticated bird in Central America.
Ah. Cool.
But none of the wild turkey subspecies do.
Oh,
so they originally thought the Miriams, which was the South Rockies bird where the Miriams came from, was the Mexican wild turkey that was domesticated went wild. But through DNA, they went, the domesticated one actually did go extinct. And so the five subspecies that we have are actually true wild genetic birds. So if you're interested in that kind of stuff, like I'll take you right back. So when you're done, it's like you are going to have like a PhD in wild turkeys. And for me, that stuff, I find one, I just love the biology and natural history of everything that's out there, but it's some way, shape, and form. Sometimes that comes back to help me in hunting. And so I'll research stuff to the ends of the earth. So
yeah, that's cool. That's awesome. Hey, how far do you think, or how high in BC do you know of that the turkeys are found?
Pete, we were just talking about this.
Yeah.
Hey, so I've heard stories of them being sighted up around Dawson Creek area.
No freaking way. Wow.
So
I would never have guessed that.
So if you think about it, it's just like when you get into the Northeast, like the Alberta Plateau just comes out of north of Edmonton, just comes right over to the Rockies. So whether you're in Northeastern BC or whether you're in Northwestern Alberta, it's kind of like, it's the same. It's the Alberta Plateau, boreal forest, farm country, that sort of thing. So I have a friend that's in Fort St. John, and he said he's heard stories of people seeing them around there. I have never heard anything since whether they've got they're getting established there or not, but I would believe that the most northerly extent is probably the ones that are just kind of up around south of the Golden area.
Wow. Yeah.
You know, the Briscoe, Edgewater, kind of like up in that part of the world. And if they are, that's the most northerly extent latitude wise of wild turkey distribution on the North American continent.
Unfortunately, in this province. Those ones there are getting absolutely hammered on the highways. A lot of them crossing back and forth on a lot of the farmers' fields and stuff with the Trans-Canada reroute. And
it's,
I go out turkey hunting every morning and you just see feathers and you're just like, no, not another one and another one.
Right. Yeah. That was happening kind of around, just outside of Kimberley a few years ago, and they put up turkey crossing signs or whatever, but
I haven't even noticed those going
their population there. is doing so well here. Like it's kind of like seeing here in the Kootenays, it's kind of like seeing a white-tailed deer that's been hit on the highway, or a couple of them go, oh my God, the population's going to be devastated. And it's like, oh my God, there's like they're breeding, spitting out as fast as they can get them.
Yeah, that's the same thing here and over here in the Okanagan. There's like birds everywhere. We've had them in residential areas, wild turkeys flocking around. So
I mean, it's one of the things that frustrates me here in British Columbia is they have a bad reputation in the wildlife management and biology field because they're not a native bird in British Columbia. So nobody wants to manage them. Nobody wants to touch them. Their populations are doing well. They're starting to become like the deer. There's flocks that are like, hey, life is pretty good living in these communities. We don't ever have to leave. a lot of conflict, shitting on my car, on my deck, scaring my dog, you know, all this kind of stuff. So the wildlife managers are being bombarded with these, and the COS is being bombarded with these, come deal with these turkeys kind of thing. And they're like, no, we're not going to come deal with them. You know, and COS is like, we are not going to come and like trap turkeys. It's like, you know, bears, yes, turkeys, no.
Yeah. Well, it's funny too, because I hear a little bit, you know, like they'll increase, you know, like the turkey harvest a little bit. They'll add the extra season at the end of the year and all this kind of stuff. And you're like, yeah, that's great. Fine. Dandy. Has got nothing to do. It's not going to affect a single bird
in any
of these towns or districts.
No, it's not. And I mean, I'm okay with a little bit of that, you know, sort of, and I helped set up the December LEH season, because it was kind of meant to deal with the conflicting landowners to say, like, look, there are some people out there with limited entry permits to come in the wintertime when they're a problem, let them on your land. Otherwise, stop phoning us and bitching about it, because, you know, and it was a little bit of a way of sort of, you know, placating the complaints to say, well, then just open your land up and let these permit holders, you know, come in and hunt them or whatever. All that really does, from the literature I've read, is it can get the turkey flocks to go back to a bit more of a natural foraging pattern across the landscape, rather than just parking it on private property. They love being around cattle and farm operations in the wintertime, because the cows are always keeping the ground and the sod turned up, and it's fresh and it's warm, and there's things to eat, bugs and seeds and whatever, and they'll just live right there. Farmers will start like feeding, grain feeding and stuff, you know, in the troughs and stuff, and, you know, in the middle of the wintertime, and the turkeys are in there. And so that's where a lot of the conflict is here in the East Kootenays, is with the ag operations. And it's unfortunately, they developed a bad reputation because of that. And it's like, it's sort of like the, you know, like, let's just increase hunting opportunity, like to get rid of the turkey. And it's like, hey, we finally have a huntable species that's got a population that's actually trending up. And the ethos within wildlife management is like, well, let's eradicate them. Like, God, right?
Come on. Like, it's like, work with me here.
work with us. So, it's one of the things I've been pushing for quite a while, and through the BC Wildlife Federation, is to get wild turkey onto a tag.
Yes. Yes. I agree too. And that was one thing when I talked to the Canadian Wild Turkey Federation, that was one of the things that their BC representative was pushing for, is to get them put on a tag system.
They were pushing for that back when the National Wild Turkey Federation had a chapter here in Cranbrook called the East Kootenay Strutters. I was part of that. They were pushing, because if I remember right, from the NWTF, British Columbia is the only jurisdiction in North America that does not have a tag for wild turkeys. And the NWTF said, we're here to help with wild turkey management, contribute to habitat projects. The chapter that's raising funds through the banquets and stuff here in British Columbia, that's a British Columbia account money. It will not go back to the States. We're here to help. But it's like, we need you, based on our policy, to have recognized the wild turkey as a game species that has a tag.
Right.
And at that time, there was a bird biologist in Victoria, avian biologist, the provincial bird biologist, that hated wild turkeys. And it was like, we kind of bumped heads a little bit and there. It's like, you know, it's like, oh, they wreak havoc on the grouse populations. And it's like, no, they don't. Here's all the scientific literature from the States. They studied it to death. They don't. They eat endangered amphibians and stuff. No, they don't. They eat seeds and spiders. It's like, they don't eat like snakes and lizards and frogs. And, you know, and it was just like all this stuff they were putting out to give turkeys a bad rap is kind of like stuck. And it's just like, I don't like the attitude towards these as a game species in the province.
Yeah, so hopefully that comes, because that will eliminate. We bumped into last year when we were hunting, we bumped into a lot of guys from Alberta that had come over without, because they just falls under the small
upland game bird. That's all they have to do is buy a non-resident hunting license and an upland game bird license.
Yeah,
so but here's the deal, actually. When a non-resident buys their hunting license, they have a fee that goes to the HCTF, same as us, when we buy the hunting license. They have to buy the upland game bird license as a non-resident. And there is a surcharge, habitat surcharge, on that they pay. Right. So they actually pay more into conservation to come here and hunt a wild turkey than we do as residents, because we don't have a tag. We just have to buy a hunting license.
Yeah. How do you feel about, I know this has been brought up before by a couple of people, if we had to pay more for our tags?
Everybody that I know seems to support the idea of increasing or paying more for tags and licenses if all that money were to go to Habitat.
Yeah, I agree. Okay. Yeah, that's what my answer is to. Amen. I don't mind paying more. I just need to know that money is going directly to this resource. It's not going to fixing a pothole somewhere else.
Yeah. I've been pushing for the tag, the species tag on wild turkey. Like, even though the entire price of the tag wouldn't go into HCTF, the surcharge will.
Right.
And it's a little bit more than what turkey hunters are contributing right now.
Right, right.
So if it's going to be like whatever, $7 or $3 or whatever off the tag is the HCTF charge, it's more than what is coming off of hunting wild turkeys as it is right now. So it's like, let's just do that. And then one day, if all of that is rolled into dedicated funding for fish and wildlife, then turkeys are right up there paying a little bit more of the share as well. So, but there's very strong opposition within government for a tag.
Oh, really?
Yep. Because it's a non-native. I've heard every excuse that you can think of to say it costs too much money to print a tag. How can we have a tag on a species that's not native? And I'm like, well, what about the bison up north? Well, they were historically native to the area. Yes, the Athabascan subspecies bison wasn't. The ones that are up there at Pink Mountain are domesticated hybrids that have gone feral. Yeah. And it's the most sought after LEH tag in the province of BC is for those bison hunts. And you charge a lot of money for them. So it's like rainbow trout in the Kootenai watershed where I am are non-native fish. Like, it's like pheasants in the Okanagan, like go on and on, right? So it's like, well, that one does, that argument doesn't hold water. And then there was a controversial thing, in my opinion, happened a couple regulation cycles ago. We were pushing for this tag for the wild turkeys for Region 8 and Region 4. And then some of the hunting groups on Vancouver Island said, oh, we're going to put in a proposal. We hate these wild turkeys on Vancouver Island, so we want to have a no close season, no bag limit on them. Let's get rid of them off the island. And they implemented it. Wow. It's like, what? And so anyways, that was used against us saying, well, how can Region 8 and Region 4 have a tag, and on Vancouver Island, they're
no
fill
tag.
Your boots 12 months of the year on them? And I'm like, well, then classify the ones on Vancouver Island as feral domestic turkeys, just like the pigs.
Right.
If they're escaped, then no close season, no bag limit. Region 4 and Region 8 has the Merriam subspecies of the North American wild turkey. Put a tag on the wild turkey.
Yeah. I'd like to see a tag on them. Definitely.
I'm all for it. I'm all for it.
Let's use the call center. Let's howl for wildlife. Everybody in North America to phone your MLAs in British Columbia and said, those guys need a species tag on wild turkey.
Yeah, I'll send John a text right now and tell him to get on it.
Get on it. Yep.
Yeah. So one more question regarding turkeys. Your favorite turkey call?
My favorite turkey call is, so it's changed. I'll tell the story. I've used a box call. I have a custom made box call from Dan's Custom Calls out of Spokane, Washington. Beautiful. Mm-hmm. It's a long box. I like that. And I use a mouth read. So the box calls I use for locating distance. And then when it's on, then I go to a mouth read, because then I'm not moving anything and I've got both hands on my firearm.
There you go.
And I can just, if I have to do a little peep here and there. And then locator calls, crow call. I probably blow the crow call more than I blow the turkey call, because I'm like you, I'm traveling the landscape trying to find where they are. Yeah. And I'm just doing that by shot gobbling. And I do some owl hooting in the dark. They don't really have to. Anything will get them to gobble.
Yeah. Yeah. Seems like when they're, if they're going to gobble, they'll, you could do anything.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. It just depends on how kind of like, you know, refined you want to be.
Right.
It's like
right.
An owl hoots at night and a crow yeah. calls during the day. And it's sort of like, or you're just going to be like, gah.
Yeah. What about like, one quick question for you, actually, that I just thought of.
Have you noticed here's the second part of this. Yeah. I'll just finish this off. I made turkey wing bone calls this winter.
Oh, really?
From the wing bones from the tom I got last spring. And I'm going to exclusively use those this year. My goal is to harvest the tom that I brought in with the turkey, handmade turkey wing bone calls.
Oh, that'd be badass.
And no camo this year.
No camo.
I am no longer.
You don't, you're not a, are you a hex guy?
I have no more camo in my, hanging on the rack over there.
Oh,
I've
yeah.
gone back to traditional wool pants and
yep.
shirt and stuff and.
Gotcha.
Plaid yeah. and whatnot. So
I'm not a big camo guy either. And a wool sweater kind of.
I mean, I will say, I do believe it can be very valuable for wild turkeys because it's close. You're at eye level with them and they can see color.
Yeah.
And they have incredibly good eyesight.
Oh, amazing.
So absolutely full camo, cover your face up, like everything, anything that shines. I've run that way for the longest time. And I've just decided I want to kind of go back a little bit more traditional. And if I'm sitting at the base of a big fir tree or a big ponderosa pine tree, and I got some brown pants on and an olive green shirt and a scarf wrapped, green scarf wrapped around my face, an old green toque or whatever, yeah. a brown toque, it's like, I'm just going to look like a lump on the ground. And I think I can fool a turkey.
Yeah. Well, it seems like I'm not the only one excited for the 15th throw around. One more quick question regarding turkeys, yep. and then we'll wrap it up. Have you noticed any difference in early springs regarding rut timing?
The strut?
The rut.
The rut.
The rut. Yeah, it's
I
called the
find up here in
it's called oh, the strut.
It, called, it is called the strut. Okay.
It's called the strut. Yep.
Oh, gotcha.
In the timing, no.
No. Okay.
No. So, but there is things that affect gobbling activity, the same as affects elk bugling activity.
Right.
So their testosterone levels are influenced by the changing daylight hours, same as every other wildlife. Mm-hmm. So they start to see peak testosterone levels in the male and estrogens in the female starts climbing because of the changing daylight in February. And so you'll see gobbling activity start ramping up in late February, March. Some of the most absolutely chaotic gobbling and breeding activity is going on in March, like chaos you will not see in the hunting season. 50, 60 turkeys, because they're still in the big winter flocks. They yeah. start fragmenting now into little bunches, like they're pushing away three, fours, and fives and stuff, and twos and you know, and whatnot. But in March, when they're still kind of in those big winter flocks and they are into the strut and there's some peak gobbling activity, man, like you actually can fear for your life out there. There's like 30 toms and jakes and they're calling and they're running around and it's just like, it's chaos. But then like what happens is you get peaks in gobbling activity and then it drops off and it might be quiet for a few days and then it'll peak again.
Right.
And then it drops off. And then yeah. basically like from the peak breeding and stuff is all happening in March.
Right.
And right. then it starts to slowly diminish out until even like close to the beginning of, you know, into May,
right.
May and even sometimes potentially early June.
Right.
So various things will affect testosterone levels. So toms don't like to gobble when it's windy.
Right.
So if you got windy days, blustery kind of days, a front moving in, your gobbling activity, they're affected by barometric pressure.
Gotcha.
They're affected by temperature. So, okay. So they have things going on, you know, in their life, or testosterone peaks and then it's down. And it's the same if you've hunted elk. It's like, it's either like they're really quiet and they'll bugle and then once, and then that's the last you'll ever hear of them. And then like 2 days later, it's like, this thing's going to come and try to gore me to death, right? Like, what the hell happened? And that's just 24, 48 hours, a bit more testosterone. And the turkeys are exactly the same way. So
Because I've noticed that is, if it's on certain years, when there's, if there's early snow melt, seems like they're more active really early when it opens, than if it's a late, then they sometimes they'll
stretch, so I think,
a little longer.
In my experience, what that is like, because they have to conduct their breeding at the same time, and that's why it's daylight controlled, right? Because the timing of the eggs, the hen needs time. She can have like 10, 14 eggs, and she lays like one a day, and then she doesn't start incubating till the last one's laid, and then incubates, and then they all hatch within a few hours of each other. So when you start pushing that in out into the summer, and then the amount of time that the poults need to like eat and grow and be of a certain size for next winter, it's no different than deer, elk. That has to happen like clockwork, regardless of the weather. But what my experience is just depending on the snow and the snow loads and areas, Merriam turkeys are not overly loyal to a piece of ground.
Right. Gotcha.
And in the spring, they do not like snow. They do not like cool areas, damp areas, draws where there's a little bit of snow sitting in the bottom. They go right out. They're looking for those warm aspects, warm ridges where your first green shoots are coming up. And in the afternoon, you're starting to get insect activity now. That's where you find them. So if you're going into an area this year and the snow melt was like gone 4 weeks ago, it was starting to green up. They're here again, right on. It's going to be good hunting season. You go back in next year and springs, and this has happened to me. It's like, it's 2 weeks behind and it's like, there's no turkeys here.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's crazy.
But I run into quite a bit.
3 weeks later, you go back in there and go, oh, okay, now they're here. Right. Like it's, they're doing the Ouija board thing on the landscape. So if you habitually go to an area and it's like, I found turkeys in here every year, right at early in April, you know, they're always here, and then all of a sudden they're not there, then they're probably not there because like the food source isn't there. It's right. Just, it hasn't greened up. It's just, so you need to go find those spots, start covering the landscape, and you'll find them somewhere.
Cool.
I've got one quick question. Where can we find you on this course that you're putting on?
So if you go to the hunterconservationist.com website, and I'm just opening it up right here, on the top, very top margin, it says podcast. There's tabs, podcast, conservation, hunt, fish, cooking, and master classes.
Nice. Okay. I'll put those up in the show notes. Good call.
So master class takes you right there to take this course, get started.
Perfect.
Purchase. Away you go.
Awesome.
Yeah. I need to learn some of this stuff that I can come. Hate to tell you, but I'm starting to head your way, because there's, like you say, I'm at the northern tip here. And I just really want to get one with my bow. So the more south I go from where I am, it gets a little bit better. So, but I need to learn to locate them too. So,
yeah. And man, it's tough this year, because it's like, I filled my truck up today and it was like $200 and it didn't get all the way full. And it's like, normally, so one of the lessons I learned was, it was sort of like, I used to like be out on the ground, like scouting. And then I was scouting too early. I did one time start scouting for the turkeys in late February, followed them through March. But that's hard, because right just before hunting season, like I said, they start to break up.
Right.
And they're not in those areas because they've all broken apart, and there's like a Tom's taken like four or five hens and they've gone way the hell over there, across the highway and way over into those hills. And this group's gone way the hell over there. So it becomes a little bit more of a needle in a haystack. So I found, if you scout too early and then leave it and you go back there at the beginning of the season, you're like, where the hell did they all go?
Yeah.
Then I've made the mistake of going. Each year I go into an area just before the season, there's some gobbles, They're in here. That's all I need to know. I'm backing out. I'll come back in here and hunt. And then the next year rolls around. It's like, they're always in that same area. I'm not going to go in there. It's like 3 a.m. I know they're going to be there. I go in there on opening day and I'm like, why the hell are there no turkeys in here? I'm like, shit. And yeah. I'm running all over the landscape going, where the hell are they? Right.
Oh yeah.
So that's going to be a bit of a tough call this year, because it's like, if I can find them right off the bat and go, yep, they're in the same old area, then good. If they're not, then I got to start going option B, C, D, E, E, all these other areas. I know I got to start hitting. And it's like, holy crap, I can't spend $200 a day.
Our tax contribution to hunting and wildlife just went up a little bit there.
Oh man. I'm even thinking I might have to just throw I had a little platform that I put in the back of the crew cabin. Like, don't drive back and forth. I might just like stay out.
Yeah. Yeah. No kidding. Cool. Well, thanks, Mark. I really appreciate you popping on with us. I know we
kind of fun.
Yeah, absolutely. You got anything for Mark, Pete?
No, that's it. I'm going to be checking out your masterclass there. I love turkeys, but I got a lot to learn too. So.
Oh yeah. You can see the look on Pete's face. He's loving it. Yeah.
Yeah. Like I said, I do not profess to be like an expert turkey hunter. But I've just learned a lot over my lifetime. These things work. I try to be very principle based in, you know, what I teach is like, here's principles, because I know somebody has to be like, I have to make this fit where I happen to be. So for example, here's a principle. When I set up decoys, I always set up the decoys because I set it up in a way so that wherever the tom is that's traveling towards, like, because he's called, he's going to come at the decoys either to my left or my right.
Right. Gotcha.
Okay. Yeah.
So I if you think of a line, like the letter T.
Yeah.
Like I sit at the base of the T, then right. The two tops of the T, he's either coming from the left or the right.
Right.
I do not want that turkey coming straight at me.
Okay. Yeah.
Because then he's looking straight at the decoys and there I am. Yeah. And there's a bigger chance he's going to go, what the hell's that underneath the tree?
Wait a sec. Yeah.
So that's a principle. I always try to set up in a way so I sit and the turkey's coming at me perpendicular from left or right. Cool. If I actually have the choice, I actually want them coming from the left. Because if you think about when you sit down and you're right-handed,
you got more stable
and you got more, you can swing your shotgun like 30 degrees left and right and still be on your knee. But if you're right-handed and you try to shoot to the right, you're now in this like this awkward position and your elbow's there you're shaking and stuff. So it's like, I like to sit and have my turkey come from the left.
Yeah. Well, that's a good tip.
So those are some principles. So somebody can go, oh, I get the principle. And then when you're out there going like, this is what I'm dealing with for the landscape, you apply the principle and then be more successful.
Awesome. Cool, man.
Cool, man.
That's great. Okay, Mark, again, thanks a lot. And Roundtable, Hunter Conservationist, all that stuff. I'll put it up in the show notes. Thanks again. It's been a blast and we'll have to do this more often.
You betcha. Yeah, it was pretty cool. Hit on all the topics.
Yeah, great. Okay, we'll talk to you later, Pete.
Yeah, have a good one.
Okay, I want to thank everyone again for tuning in to another episode of the Folks Hunting Podcast, which is coming at you as part of the Waypoint Outdoors Collective. This episode of the Focus Hunting Podcast is brought to you by Vortex Optics, the best in optics, period. Backroads Maps, never get lost with Backroads Maps. And AKU Boots, you owe it to your feet. Quick shout out to Howl for Wildlife. If you guys are not familiar with Howl for Wildlife, make sure you head on over to howlforwildlife.org. Become a member, doesn't cost you anything. They got tons of great stuff going on, and we're going to be working with them getting some Canadian issues put on their platform. Thanks again, everybody.